Another Jesuit professor, Joseph Siebes, was one of the most remarkable men I've ever known. Lean and stoop-shouldered, he was a gifted linguist whose primary interest was Asia. He had been working in China when the communists prevailed, and spent some time in captivity, much of it in a small hole in the ground. The abuse damaged his stomach, cost him a kidney, and kept him in poor health for much of the rest of his life. He taught a course called Comparative Cultures. It should have been entitled Religions of the World. We studied Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, Shintoism, Confucianism, Taoism, Hinduism, Jainism, Zoroastrianism, and other faiths. I loved Siebes and learned a lot from him about how people the world over defined God, truth, and the good life. Knowing how many of the students came from foreign countries, he offered everyone the chance to take the final exam orally in 9 languages. In the second semester, I got an A, one of only 4 that were given, and one of my proudest academic achievements. My other 2 teachers were real characters. Robert Irving taught English to freshmen who were unprepared for his rapid-fire, acid commentary on the propensity of freshmen to be verbose and imprecise. He wrote withering comments in the margins of essays, calling one of his students a capricious little bilge pump, responding to another's expression of chagrin with, "Turned into a cabbage, did you?" My papers received more pedestrian rebukes. In the margins or at the end, Dr. Irving wrote awk for awkward, ugh, rather dull, pathetic. On one paper I saved, he finally wrote clever and thoughtful, only to follow it by asking me to next time be a sport and write my essay on better paper. One day Dr. Irving read aloud an essay one of his former students had written on Marvel, to illustrate the importance of using language with care. The student noted that Marvel loved his wife even after she died, then added the unfortunate sentence, "Of course, physical love, for the most part, ends after death." Irving roared, "For the most part? For the most part! I suppose to some people there's nothing better on a warm day than a nice cold corpse." That was a little rich for a bunch of 18-year-old Catholic school kids and one Southern Baptist. Wherever he is today, I dread the thought of Dr. Irving reading this book and can only imagine the scorching comments he's scribbling in the margins. The most legendary class at Georgetown was Professor Carol Quigley's Development of Civilizations, a requirement for all freshmen, with more than 200 people in each class. Though difficult, the class was wildly popular because of Quigley's intellect, opinions, and antics. The antics included his discourse on the reality of paranormal phenomena, including his claim to have seen a table rise off the floor and a woman take flight at a séance, and his lecture condemning Plato's elevation of absolute rationality over observed experience, which he delivered every year at the end of the course. He always closed the lecture by ripping apart a paperback copy of Plato's Republic, then throwing it across the room, shouting, "Plato is a fascist!" The exams were filled with mind-bending questions like, "Write a brief but well-organized history of the Balkan Peninsula from the start of the Verm Glacier to the time of Homer," and, "What is the relationship between the process of cosmic evolution and the dimension of abstraction?" 2 of Quigley's insights had a particularly lasting impact. First, he said that societies have to develop organized instruments to achieve their military, political, economic, social, religious, and intellectual objectives. The problem, according to Quigley, is that all instruments eventually become institutionalized, that is, vested interests more committed to preserving their own prerogatives than to meeting the needs for which they were created. Once this happens, change can come only through reform or circumvention of the institutions. If these fail, reaction and decline set in. His second lasting insight concerned the key to the greatness of Western civilization and its continuing capacity for reform and renewal. He said, "Our civilization's success is rooted in unique religious and philosophical convictions that man is basically good, that there is truth, but no finite mortal has it, that we can get closer to the truth only by working together, and that through faith and good works, we can have a better life in this world and a reward in the next." According to Quigley, these ideas gave our civilization its optimistic, pragmatic character and an unwavering belief in the possibility of positive change. He summed up our ideology with the term future preference, the belief that the future can be better than the past, and each individual has a personal moral obligation to make it so. From the 1992 campaign through my two terms in office, I quoted Professor Quigley's line often, hoping it would spur my fellow Americans and me to practice what he preached. By the end of my first year, I had been dating my first long-term girlfriend for a few months. Denise Hyland was a tall, freckle-faced Irish girl with kind, beautiful eyes and an infectious smile. She was from Upper Montclair, New Jersey, the second of six children of a doctor who was studying to be a priest before he met her mother. Denise and I broke up at the end of our junior year, but our friendship has endured. I was glad to be going home, where at least I'd have old friends and my beloved hot summer. I had a job waiting for me at Camp Yorktown Bay, a Navy League camp for poor kids mostly from Texas and Arkansas on Lake Ouachita, the largest of Hot Springs' three lakes and one of the cleanest in America. You could see the bottom clearly at a depth of more than 30 feet. The man-made lake was in the Ouachita National Forest, so development around it with the attendant pollution runoff was limited. For several weeks, I got up early every morning and drove out to the camp, 20 miles or so away, where I supervised swimming, basketball, and other camp activities. A lot of the kids needed a week away from their lives. One came from a family of six kids and a single mother and didn't have a penny to his name when he arrived. His mother was moving and he didn't know where he'd be living when he got back. I talked with one boy who tried unsuccessfully to swim and was in bad shape when he was pulled out of the lake. He said it was nothing. In his short life, he'd already swallowed his tongue, been poisoned, survived a bad car wreck, and lost his father 3 months earlier. The summer passed quickly, full of good times with my friends and interesting letters from Denise, who was in France. There was one last terrible incident with Daddy. One day he came home early from work, drunk and mad. I was over at the Yeldells, but luckily Roger was home. Daddy went after Mother with a pair of scissors and pushed her into the laundry room off the kitchen. Roger ran out the front door and over to the Yeldell screaming, "Bubba, help! Daddy's killing Daddo!" When Roger was a baby, he could say Daddy before he could say Mother, so he created the term Daddo for her, and he used it for a long time afterward. I ran back to the house, pulled Daddy off Mother, and grabbed the scissors from him. I took Mother and Roger to the living room, then went back and reamed Daddy out. When I looked into his eyes, I saw more fear than rage. Not long before, he had been diagnosed with cancer of the mouth and throat. The doctors recommended radical and disfiguring surgery, but he refused, so they treated him as best they could. This incident took place early in the 2-year period leading to his death, and I think it was his shame at the way he had lived and his fear of dying that drove him to what would be his last bad outburst. After that, he still drank, but he became more withdrawn and passive. This incident had a particularly devastating effect on my brother. Almost 40 years later, he told me how humiliated he had felt running for assistance, how helpless he felt that he couldn't stop his father, how irrevocable his hatred was after that. I realized then how foolish I'd been. In the immediate aftermath of the episode, to revert to our family policy of just pretending nothing had happened and going back to normal. Instead, I should have told Roger that I was very proud of him, that it was his alertness, love, and courage that had saved Mother. That what he did was harder than what I had done. That he needed to let go of his hatred because his father was sick, and hating his father would only spread the sickness to him. Oh, I often wrote to Roger and called him a lot when I was away. I encouraged him in his studies and activities and told him I loved him. But I missed the deep scarring and the trouble it would inevitably bring. It took Roger a long time and a lot of self-inflicted wounds to finally get to the source of the hurt in his heart. Though I still had some concerns about Mother's and Roger's safety, I believed Daddy when he promised he was through with violence. And besides, he was losing the capacity to generate it, so I was ready when the time came to go back to Georgetown for my second year. In June, I had been awarded a $500 scholarship, and the requirement to wear tie and shirt to class had been scrapped, so I was looking forward to a more affluent existence on my $25 a week. I also had been re-elected president of my class, this time with a real program concentrating on campus issues, including non-denominational religious services and a community service initiative we took over from the outgoing senior class. GUCAP, the Georgetown University Community Action Program, which sent student volunteers into poor neighborhoods to help kids with their studies. We also tutored adults working for high school diplomas through an extension program and did whatever else we could to help families struggling to get by. I went a few times, although not as often as I should have. Along with what I knew from growing up in Arkansas, I saw enough of inner city Washington to convince me that volunteer charity alone would never be enough to overcome the grinding combination of poverty, discrimination, and lack of opportunity that held so many of my fellow citizens back. It made my support for President Johnson's civil rights, voting rights, and anti-poverty initiatives even stronger. My second year, like the first, was primarily focused on classwork, really for the last time. From then on, through my final 2 years at Georgetown, the stay in Oxford, and law school, my formal studies increasingly fought a losing battle with politics, personal experiences, and private explorations. For now, there was more than enough to hold my attention in the classroom, starting with second-year German, Mary Bond's absorbing course on major British writers, and Ulrich Ahler's History of Political Thought. Ahler's was a gruff German who noted these few words on a paper I wrote on the ancient Athenian legal system. Plodding but very decent. At the time, I felt damned with faint praise. After I had been president a few years, I would have killed to be called that. I made a C in Joe White's microeconomics class first semester. Professor White also taught macroeconomics second semester, and I got an A in that class. I suppose both grades were harbingers, since as president I did a good job with the nation's economy and a poor job with my personal economic situation, at least until I left the White House. I studied European history with Luis Aguilar, a Cuban expatriate who had been a leader of the Democratic opposition to Batista before he was overthrown by Castro. Once, Aguilar asked me what I intended to do with my life. I told him that I wanted to go home and get into politics, but that I was becoming interested in a lot of other things, too. He replied wistfully, "Choosing a career is like choosing a wife from 10 girlfriends. Even if you pick the most beautiful, the most intelligent, the kindest woman, there is still the pain of losing the other 9. Though he loved teaching and was good at it, I had the feeling that for Professor Aguilar, Cuba was those other 9 women rolled into 1. My most memorable class sophomore year was Professor Walter Giles' U.S. Constitution and Government, a course he taught largely through Supreme Court cases. Giles was a red-headed, crew-cut, confirmed bachelor whose life was filled by his students, his love for the Constitution and social justice, and his passion for the Washington Redskins, win or lose. He invited students to his house for dinners, and a lucky few even got to go with him to see the Redskins play. Giles was a liberal Democrat from Oklahoma, not common then, and rare enough today to place him under the protection of the Endangered Species Act. I think he took an interest in me partly because I was from a state that bordered his own, though he liked to kid me about it. By the time I got to his class, I had embraced my lifelong affinity for sleep deprivation and had developed the sometimes embarrassing habit of falling asleep for 5 or 10 minutes in class, after which I'd be fine. I sat in the front row of Giles's big lecture class, a perfect foil for his biting wit. One day, as I was napping, he noted loudly that a certain Supreme Court ruling was so crystal clear anyone could understand it, unless, of course, you're from some hick town in Arkansas. I awoke with a start to peals of laughter from my classmates and never fell asleep on him again. Chapter 10. After my sophomore year, I went home without a job, but with a clear idea of what I wanted to do. It was the end of an era in Arkansas. After 6 terms, Orville Faubus wasn't running for re-election as governor. Finally, our state would have a chance to move beyond the scars of Little Rock and the stains of cronyism that also tainted his later years. I wanted to work in the governor's race, both to learn about politics and to do what little I could to put Arkansas on a more progressive course. The pent-up ambitions from the Faubus years propelled several candidates into the race, 7 Democrats and 1 very big Republican, Winthrop Rockefeller, the 5th of the 6 children of John D. Rockefeller, Jr., who left his father's empire to oversee the charitable efforts of the Rockefeller Foundation, left his father's conservative, anti-labor politics under the influence of his more liberal wife, Abby, and the great Canadian liberal politician, Mackenzie King. And finally left his father's conservative religious views to found the interdenominational Riverside Church in New York City with Harry Emerson Fosdick. Winthrop had seemed destined to be the black sheep of the family. He was expelled from Yale and went to work in the Texas oil fields. After distinguished service in World War II, he married a New York socialite and reacquired his reputation as a hard-partying dilettante. In 1953, he moved to Arkansas, partly because he had a wartime buddy from there who interested him in the possibilities of setting up a ranching operation, and partly because the state had a 30-day divorce law and he was eager to end his brief first marriage. Rockefeller was a huge man, about 6'4", weighing about 250 pounds. He really took to Arkansas, where everybody called him Win, not a bad name for a politician. He always wore cowboy boots and a white Stetson hat, which became his trademark. He bought a huge chunk of Petagene Mountain, about 50 miles west of Little Rock, became a successful breeder of Santa Gertrudis cattle, and married his second wife, Jeanette. As he settled into his adopted state, Rockefeller worked hard to shed the playboy image that had dogged him in New York. He built up the small Arkansas Republican Party and worked to bring industry to our poor state. Governor Faubus appointed him chairman of the Arkansas Industrial Development Commission, and he brought in a lot of new jobs. In 1964, impatient with Arkansas's backward image, he challenged Faubus for governor. Everybody appreciated what he had done, but Faubus had an organization in every county. Most people, especially in rural Arkansas, still supported his segregationist position over Rockefeller's pro-civil rights stance, and Arkansas was still a Democratic state. Also, the painfully shy Rockefeller was a poor speaker, a problem aggravated by his legendary drinking habits, which also made him so late so often that he made me look punctual. Once, he arrived inebriated and more than an hour late to address the Chamber of Commerce banquet in Wynn, county seat of Cross County, in eastern Arkansas. When he got up to speak, he said, "I'm glad to be here in..." When he realized he didn't know where he was, he whispered to the master of ceremonies, "Where am I?" The man whispered back, "When?" He asked again and got the same answer. Then he boomed out, "Damn it, I know my name. Where am I?" That story crossed the state like wildfire. but was usually told good-naturedly, because everybody knew Rockefeller was an Arkansan by choice and had the state's best interest at heart. In 1966, Rockefeller was running again, but even with Faubus gone, I didn't think he could make it. Besides, I wanted to back a progressive Democrat. My sentimental favorite was Brooks Hayes, who had lost his seat in Congress in 1958 for supporting the integration of Little Rock Central High. He was defeated by a segregationist optometrist, Dr. Dale Alford, in a write-in campaign which succeeded partly because of the use of stickers with his name on them that could be plastered on ballots by voters who couldn't write but were smart enough to know that blacks and whites shouldn't go to school together. Hayes was a devout Christian who had served as president of the Southern Baptist Convention before the majority of my fellow Baptists decided that only conservatives could lead them or the country. He was a marvelous man, bright, humble, funny as all get out, and kind to a fault, even to his opponents, young campaign workers. Ironically, Dr. Alford was in the race for governor, too, and he couldn't win either, because the racists had a far more fervent champion in Justice Jim Johnson, who had risen from humble roots in Crossett in southeast Arkansas to the state Supreme Court on rhetoric that won the endorsement of the Ku Klux Klan in the governor's race. He thought Faubus was too soft on civil rights. After all, he had appointed a few blacks to state boards and commissions. With Faubus, who had genuine populist impulses, racism was a political imperative. He preferred improving schools and nursing homes, building roads, and reforming the state mental hospital to race baiting. It was just the price of staying in office. With Johnson, racism was theology. He thrived on hate. He had sharp features and bright, wild eyes, giving him a lean and hungry look that would have made Shakespeare's Cassius green with envy. And he was a savvy politician who knew where his voters were. Instead of going to the endless campaign rallies where the other candidates spoke, he traveled all over the state on his own with a country and western band, which he used to pull in a crowd. Then he would whip them into a frenzy with tirades against blacks and their traitorous white sympathizers. I didn't see it at the time, but he was building strength among people the other candidates couldn't reach. People upset with federal activism and civil rights, scared by the Watts riots and other racial disturbances, convinced the war on poverty was socialist welfare for blacks, and frustrated with their own economic conditions. Psychologically, we're all a complex mixture of hopes and fears. Each day, we wake up with the scales tipping a bit one way or the other. If they go too far toward hopefulness, we can become naive and unrealistic. If the scales tilt too far the other way, we can get consumed by paranoia and hatred. In the South, the dark side of the scales has always been the bigger problem. In 1966, Jim Johnson was just the man to tip them in that direction. The best candidate with a good shot at winning was another Supreme Court justice and a former attorney general, Frank Holt. He had the support of most of the courthouse crowd and the big financial interest, but he was more progressive on race than Faubus and completely honest and decent. Frank Holt was admired by just about everybody who knew him, except those who thought he was too easygoing to make any real change, had wanted to be governor all his life, and also wanted to redeem his family's legacy. His brother Jack, who was more of an old-fashioned Southern populist, had lost a Senate race to our conservative senior senator John McClellan a few years before. My uncle Raymond Clinton was a big supporter of Holt's and told me he thought he could get me on the campaign. Holt already had secured the support of a number of student leaders from Arkansas colleges who called themselves the Holt Generation. Before long, I got hired at $50 a week. I think Uncle Raymond paid my way. Since I had been living on $25 a week at Georgetown, I felt rich. The other students were a little older and a lot better connected than I was. Mac Glover had been president of the University of Arkansas student body. Dick King had been president of the student body at Arkansas State Teachers College. Paul Frey was president of the Young Democrats at Ouachita Baptist. Bill Allen was a former Arkansas Boy State governor and student leader at Memphis State, just across the Mississippi River from Arkansas. Leslie Smith was a beautiful, smart girl from a powerful political family who had been Arkansas Junior Miss. At the start of the campaign, I was definitely a second stringer in the Holt generation. My assignments included nailing Holt for Governor signs on trees, trying to get people to put his bumper stickers on their cars, and handing out his brochures at rallies around the state. One of the most important rallies, then and later, when I became a candidate, was the Mount Nebo Chicken Fry. Mount Nebo is a beautiful spot overlooking the Arkansas River in Yell County in western Arkansas, where the Clintons originally settled. People would show up for the food, the music, and a long stream of speeches by candidates, beginning with those running for local office and ending with those running for governor. Not long after I got there and began working the crowd, our opponents started to arrive. Judge Holt was running late. When his opponents began speaking, he still wasn't there. I was getting worried. This was not an event to miss. I went to a payphone and somehow tracked him down, which was a lot harder before cell phones. He said that he just couldn't get there before the speeches were over and that I should speak for him. I was surprised and asked if he was sure. He said I knew what he stood for and I should just tell the people that. When I told the event organizers Judge Holt couldn't make it and asked if I could speak in his place, I was scared to death. It was much worse than speaking for myself. After I finished, the people gave me a polite reception. I don't remember what I said, but it must have been okay, because after that, along with my sign and bumper sticker duties, I was asked to stand in for Judge Holt at a few smaller rallies he couldn't attend. There were so many, no candidate could make them all. Arkansas has 75 counties, and several counties held more than one rally. After a few weeks, the campaign decided that the judge's wife, Mary, and his daughters, Lida and Melissa, should go on the road to cover places he couldn't. Mary Holt was a tall, intelligent, independent woman who owned a fashionable dress shop in Little Rock. Lida was a student at Mary Baldwin College in Staunton, Virginia, where Woodrow Wilson was born. Melissa was in high school. They were all attractive and articulate, and they all adored Judge Holt and were really committed to the campaign. All they needed was a driver. Somehow, I was chosen. We crisscrossed the state. We were gone a week at a time, coming back to Little Rock to wash our clothes and recharge for another lap. It was great fun. I really got to know the state and learned a lot from hours of conversation with Mary and her daughters. One night, we went to Hope for a rally on the courthouse steps. Because my grandmother was in the crowd, Mary graciously invited me to speak to the hometown folks, though Lida was supposed to do it. I think they both knew I wanted the chance to show that I'd grown up. The crowd gave me a good listen, and I even got a nice write-up in the local paper, the Hope Star, which tickled Daddy because when he had the Buick dealership in Hope, the editor disliked him so much he got an ugly mongrel dog, named him Roger, and frequently let the dog loose near the Buick place so he could go down the street after him shouting, "Come here, Roger! Here, Roger!" That night I took Lida to see the house where I had spent my first 4 years and the wooden railroad overpass where I'd played. The next day we went out to the cemetery to visit the graves of Mary Holt's family, and I showed them my father's and grandfather's graves. I treasure the memories of those road trips. I was used to being bossed around by women, so we got along well, and I think I was useful to them. I changed flat tires, helped a family get out of a burning house, and got eaten alive by mosquitoes so big you could feel them puncture your skin. We passed the hours of driving by talking about politics, people, and books, and I think we got some votes. Not long before the Hope rally, the campaign decided to put on a 15-minute TV program featuring the students who were working for Judge Holt. They thought it would position him as the candidate of Arkansas's future. Several of us spoke for a couple of minutes about why we were supporting him. I don't know if it did any good, but I enjoyed my first TV appearance, though I didn't get to watch it. I had to speak at yet another rally in Allred, a remote community in Van Buren County in the mountains of north central Arkansas. The candidates who made it way up there usually got the votes, and I was beginning to realize that we needed all we could get. As the hot summer weeks passed, I saw more and more evidence that the old South had given up the ghost and the new South wasn't yet powerful enough to chase it away. Most of our schools were still segregated, and resistance remained strong. One county courthouse in the Mississippi Delta still had white and colored designations on the doors of the public restrooms. When I asked one elderly black lady in another town to vote for Judge Holt, she said she couldn't because she hadn't paid her poll tax. I told her that Congress had eliminated the poll tax 2 years earlier, and all she had to do was register. I don't know if she did. Still, there were signs of a new day. While campaigning in Arkadelphia, 35 miles south of Hot Springs, I met the leading candidate for the South Arkansas congressional seat, a young man named David Pryor. He was clearly a progressive who thought if he could just meet enough people, he could persuade most of them to vote for him. He did it in 1966, did it again in the governor's race in 1974, and again in the Senate race in 1978. By the time he retired, much to my dismay, from the Senate in 1996, David Pryor was the most popular politician in Arkansas with a fine progressive legacy. Everybody thought of him as their friend, including me. The kind of retail politics Pryor mastered was important in a rural state like Arkansas, where more than half the people lived in towns with fewer than 5,000 people, and tens of thousands just lived out in the country. We were still in the days before television ads, especially the negative ones, assumed the large role in elections they have now. Candidates mostly bought television time to look into the camera and talk to the voters. They also were expected to visit the courthouses and main businesses in every county seat, go into the kitchen of every cafe, and campaign in sale barns where livestock are auctioned. The county fairs and pie suppers were fertile territory. And, of course, every weekly newspaper and radio station expected a visit and an ad or two. That's how I learned politics. I think it works better than TV air wars. You could talk, but you had to listen, too. You had to answer voters' tough questions face to face. Of course, you could still be demonized, but at least your adversaries had to work harder to do it. And when you took a shot at your opponent, you had to take it, not hide behind some bogus committee that expected to make a killing from your time in office if its attacks destroyed the other candidate. Though the campaigns were more personal, they were far from just personality contests. When there were big issues at stake, they had to be addressed. And if a strong tide of public opinion was rolling in, and you couldn't go with the flow in good conscience, you had to be tough, disciplined, and quick to avoid being washed away. In 1966, Jim Johnson, or Justice Jim, as he liked to be called, was riding the tide and making big, ugly waves. He attacked Frank Holt as a pleasant vegetable and implied that Rockefeller had had homosexual relations with black men, a laughable charge considering his earlier well-earned reputation as a ladies' man. Justice Jim's message was simply the latest version of an old Southern song sung to white voters in times of economic and social uncertainty. You're good, decent, God-fearing people. They're threatening your way of life, and you don't have to change. It's all their fault. Elect me, and I'll stand up for you just as you are and kick the hell out of them. The perennial political divide, us versus them. It was mean, ugly, and ultimately self-defeating for the people who bought it. But as we still see, when people feel discontented and insecure, it often works. Because Johnson was so extreme in his rhetoric and largely invisible on the traditional campaign trail, most political observers thought it wouldn't work this time. As Election Day neared, Frank Holt refused to answer his attacks, or the attacks from other candidates, who assumed he was way ahead and also began to hit him for being the old guard machine candidate. We didn't have many polls back then, and most people didn't put much stock in the few that floated around. Holt's strategy sounded good to the idealistic young people around him like me. He simply replied to all charges with a statement that he was completely independent, that he wouldn't respond to unsubstantiated attacks or attack his opponents in return, and that he wanted to win on his own merits or not at all. I finally learned that phrases like "or not at all" are often used by candidates who forget that politics is a contact sport. The strategy can work when the public mood is secure and hopeful, and when the candidate has a platform of serious, specific policy proposals. But in the summer of 1966, the mood was mixed at best, and the Holt platform was too general to inspire much intense feeling. Besides, those who most wanted a candidate who simply embodied opposition to segregation could vote for Brooks Hayes. Despite the attacks on him, most people thought Frank Holt would lead the ticket, but without a majority, and then would win the runoff 2 weeks later. On July 26th, the people spoke, more than 420,000 of them. The results surprised the pundits. Johnson led with 25% of the vote, Holt was second with 23%, Hayes was third with 15%, Alford got 13%, and the other three split the rest. We were shocked, but not without hope. Judge Holt and Brooke Hayes had gotten slightly more votes between them than the segregationist combo of Johnson and Alford. Also, in one of the more interesting legislative races, a long-serving old guard House member, Paul Van Dalsum, was defeated by a young, progressive, Yale-educated lawyer, Herb Rule. A couple of years earlier, Van Dalsum had infuriated supporters of the rising women's movement by saying women should be kept at home, barefoot and pregnant. That got Herb, later Hillary's partner at the Rose Law Firm, an army of female volunteers who dubbed themselves Barefoot Women for Rule. The outcome of the runoff election was very much up in the air, because runoffs are about voter turnout, about which candidate will do a better job of getting his own voters back to the polls and a better job of persuading those who voted for candidates who were eliminated or people who didn't vote the first time to support him. Judge Holt tried hard to make the runoff a choice between the Old South and the New South. Johnson didn't exactly undermine that framing of the race when he went on TV to tell the voters that he stood with Daniel in the lion's den and with John the Baptist in Herod's court in opposing godless integration. I think somewhere in that talk, Justice Jim even got on Paul Revere's horse. Though the Holt strategy was smart and Johnson was willing to fight it out as old versus new, there were two problems with Holt's approach. First, the Old South voters were highly motivated to vote, and they were sure Johnson was their champion, while the New South voters weren't so sure about Holt. His refusal to really take the gloves off until late in the race reinforced their doubts and reduced their incentive to vote. Second, an undetermined number of Rockefeller supporters wanted to vote for Johnson because they thought he'd be easier than Holt for their man to beat. And anyone, Republican or Democrat, could vote in the Democratic runoff as long as he or she hadn't voted in the Republican primary. Only 19,646 people had done that since Rockefeller was unopposed. On runoff election day, only 5,000 fewer people voted than in the first primary. Each candidate got twice as many votes as the first time, and Johnson won by 15,000 votes, 52-48%. I was sick about the outcome. I had come to care deeply about Judge Holt and his family, to believe he would have been a better governor than he was a candidate, and to dislike what Justice Jim stood for even more. The only bright spot was Rockefeller, who actually had a chance to win. He was a better organized candidate the second time around. He spent money as if it was going out of style, even buying hundreds of bicycles for poor black kids. In the fall, he won with 54.5% of the vote. I was very proud of my state. I had gone back to Georgetown by then and didn't watch the campaign unfold firsthand, but a lot of people commented that Johnson seemed less animated in the general election. Perhaps it was because his financial support was limited, but there was also a rumor that he might have gotten some encouragement from Rockefeller to cool it. I have no idea if that was true or not. Except for a brief interregnum in the Carter years when I was President Carter's point man in Arkansas, and when he wanted a federal appointment for his son, Jim Johnson remained way out there on the right, where he grew more and more hostile toward me. In the 1980s, like so many Southern conservatives, he became a Republican. He ran again for the Supreme Court and lost. After that, he made his mischief in the background. When I ran for president, he planted ingenious stories directly and indirectly with anyone gullible enough to believe them, and got some surprising takers among the so-called Eastern liberal media he loved to revile, especially for Whitewater tales. He's a canny old rascal. He must have had a great time conning them, and if the Republicans in Washington had succeeded in running me out of town, he'd have had a good claim to the last laugh. After the campaign, I got to wind down by taking my first trip to the West Coast. A regular customer of Uncle Raymond's wanted a new Buick he didn't have in stock. Uncle Raymond found one at a dealership in Los Angeles where it was being used as a demonstrator, a car prospective customers could test drive to see how they liked it. Dealers often swapped these cars or sold them to one another at a discount. My uncle asked me to fly out to L.A. and drive the car back, along with Pat Brady, whose mother was his secretary, and who had been in my high school class and the band. If we both went, we could drive straight through. We were eager to go, and back then student fares were so cheap Raymond could fly us out for nearly nothing and still make a profit on the car. We flew into LAX, got the car, and headed home, but not in a straight line. Instead, we took a minor detour to Las Vegas, a place we thought we'd never have another chance to see. I still remember driving across the flat desert at night with the windows down, feeling the warm, dry air, and seeing the bright lights of Vegas beckoning in the distance. Las Vegas was different then. There were no big theme hotels like the Paris or the Venetian, just the Strip, with its gambling and entertainment. Pat and I didn't have much money, but we wanted to play the slot machines, so we picked a place, got a roll of nickels each, and went to work. Within 15 minutes, I had hit one jackpot and Pat had pulled two. This did not go unnoticed by the regular hostages to the one-armed bandits. They were convinced we were good luck, so every time we left a machine without hitting, people rushed to it, jostling for the right to pull up the jackpot we had left waiting for them. We couldn't understand it. We were convinced that we'd completely used up years of luck in those few minutes, and we didn't want to squander it. We got back on the road with most of our winnings still bulging in our pockets. I don't think anyone carries that many nickels anymore. After we turned the car into Uncle Raymond, who didn't seem to mind the side trip, I had to get ready to go back to Georgetown. At the end of the campaign, I had spoken to Jack Holt about my interest in going to work for Senator Fulbright, but I didn't know if anything would come of it. I had written Fulbright for a job the previous spring and had received a letter back saying there were no vacancies, but they'd keep my letter on file. I doubted things had changed, but a few days after getting back to Hot Springs, I got a call early in the morning from Lee Williams, Fulbright's administrative assistant. Lee said Jack Holt had recommended me, and there was a job opening as an assistant clerk on the Foreign Relations Committee. He said, "You can have a part-time job for $3,500 or a full-time job for $5,000. Even though I was sleepy, I couldn't miss that one. I said, "How about two part-time jobs?" He laughed and said I was just the kind of person he was looking for, and I should report for work Monday morning. I was so excited I could have popped. The Foreign Relations Committee under Fulbright had become the center of national debate over foreign policy, especially the escalating war in Vietnam. Now I would witness the drama unfold firsthand, albeit as a flunky, and I would be able to pay for college without any help from mother and daddy, taking the financial burden off them and the guilt burden off me. I had worried about how in the world they could afford daddy's medical treatments on top of the cost of Georgetown. Though I never told anyone at the time, I was afraid I'd have to leave Georgetown and come home, where college was so much less expensive. Now, out of the blue, I had the chance to stay on at Georgetown and work for the Foreign Relations Committee. I owe so much of the rest of my life to Jack Holt for recommending me for that job, and to Lee Williams for giving it to me. Chapter 11. A couple of days after Lee Williams called, I was packed and ready to drive back to Washington in a gift. Since my new job required me to get to Capitol Hill every day, Mother and Daddy gave me their old car, a 3-year-old white convertible Buick LeSabre with a white and red leather interior. Daddy got a new car every 3 years or so and turned the old one in to be sold on the used car lot. This time I replaced the used car lot, and I was ecstatic. It was a beautiful car. Though it got only 7 or 8 miles to the gallon, gas was cheap, dropping under 30 cents per gallon when there was a gas war on. On my first Monday back in Washington, as instructed, I presented myself in Senator Fulbright's office, the first office on the left in what was then called the New Senate Office Building, now the Dirksen Building. Like the old Senate office building across the street, it is a grand marble edifice, but much brighter. I had a good talk with Lee, then was taken upstairs to the fourth floor, where the Foreign Relations Committee had its offices and hearing room. The committee also had a much grander space in the Capitol building, where the chief of staff, Carl Marcy, and a few of the senior staff worked. There was also a beautiful conference room where the committee could meet privately. When I arrived at the committee office, I met Buddy Kendrick, the documents clerk, who would be my supervisor, fellow storyteller, and provider of homespun advice over the next 2 years. Buddy's full-time assistant, Bertie Bowman, a big, kind-hearted African-American who moonlighted as a cab driver and also drove Senator Fulbright on occasion, and my two student counterparts, Phil Dozier from Arkansas and Charlie Parks, a law student from Anniston, Alabama. I was told I would be taking memos and other materials back and forth between the Capitol and Senator Fulbright's office, including confidential material for which I would have to receive proper government clearance. Beyond that, I would do whatever was required, from reading newspapers and clipping important articles for the staff and interested senators, to answering requests for speeches and other materials, to adding names to the committee's mailing list. Keep in mind that this was before computers and email, even before modern copying machines, though while I was there we did graduate from copies made on carbon paper while typing or writing to rudimentary Xerox copies. Most of the newspaper articles I clipped were never copied. They were simply put into a big folder every day with a routing sheet that had the names of the committee staff from the chairman on down. Each person would receive and review them, check off his or her name on the sheet, and pass them along. The main mailing lists were kept in the basement. Each name and address was typed onto a small metal plate. Then the plates were stored in alphabetical order in file cabinets. When we sent a mailing out, the plates were put into a machine that inked them and stamped the imprints on the envelopes as they passed through. I enjoyed going to the basement to type new names and addresses on the plates and put them in the file drawers. Since I was always exhausted, I often took a nap down there, sometimes just leaning against the file cabinets. And I really loved reading the newspapers and clipping articles for the staff to read. For nearly 2 years, every day, I read the New York Times, the Washington Post, the now-defunct Washington Star, the Wall Street Journal, the Baltimore Sun, and the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. The last because it was thought the committee should see at least one good Heartland newspaper. When McGeorge Bundy was President Kennedy's national security advisor, he remarked that any citizen who read 6 good newspapers a day would know as much as he did. I don't know about that, but after I did what he recommended for 16 months, I did know enough to survive my Rhodes Scholarship interview. And if Trivial Pursuit had been around back then, I might have been national champion. We also handled requests for documents. The committee produced a lot of them, reports on foreign trips, expert testimony and hearings, and full hearing transcripts. The deeper we got into Vietnam, the more Senator Fulbright and his allies tried to use the hearing process to educate Americans about the complexities of life and politics in North and South Vietnam, the rest of Southeast Asia, and China. The document room was our regular workplace. In the first year, I worked my half day in the afternoon from 1 to 5. Because the committee hearings and other business often ran beyond that, I often stayed after 5 o'clock and never begrudged it. I liked the people I worked with, and I liked what Senator Fulbright was doing with the committee. It was easy to fit the job into my daily schedule, partly because in junior year only 5 courses were required instead of 6, partly because some classes started as early as 7 a.m. 3 of my requirements, U.S. history and diplomacy, modern foreign governments, and theory and practice of communism, complemented my new work. Scheduling was also easier because I didn't run again for president of the class. Every day I looked forward to the end of classes and the drive to Capitol Hill. It was easier to find parking then, and it was a fascinating time to be there. The vast majority that had carried Lyndon Johnson to his landslide victory in 1964 was beginning to unravel. In a few months, the Democrats would see their majorities in the House and Senate diminish in the 1966 midterm elections as the country moved to the right in reaction to riots, social unrest, and the rise of inflation. And President Johnson escalated both domestic spending and our involvement in Vietnam. He claimed our country could afford both guns and butter, but the people were beginning to doubt it. In his first 2.5 years as president, Johnson had enjoyed the most stunning legislative successes since FDR. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, sweeping anti-poverty legislation, and Medicare and Medicaid, which at last guaranteed medical care for the poor and elderly. Now more and more the attention of the president, the Congress, and the country was turning to Vietnam. As the death toll mounted with no victory in sight, rising opposition to the war took many forms, from protests on campuses to sermons from pulpits, from arguments in coffee shops to speeches on the floor of Congress. When I went to work for the Foreign Relations Committee, I didn't know enough about Vietnam to have a strong opinion, but I was so supportive of President Johnson that I gave him the benefit of the doubt. Still, it was clear that events were conspiring to undermine the magic moment of progress ushered in by his landslide election. The country was dividing over more than Vietnam. The Watts riots in Los Angeles in 1965 and the rise of militant black activists pushed their sympathizers to the left and their opponents to the right. The Voting Rights Act, of which LBJ was particularly and justifiably proud, had a similar effect, especially as it began to be enforced. Johnson was an uncommonly shrewd politician. He said that when he signed the voting rights legislation, that he had just killed the Democratic Party in the South for a generation. In fact, the so-called solid South of the Democrats had been far from solid for a long time. The conservative Democrats had been falling away since 1948 when they recoiled at Hubert Humphrey's barn-burning civil rights speech at the Democratic Convention and Strom Thurmond bolted the party to run for president as a Dixiecrat. In 1960, Johnson helped Kennedy hold enough southern states to win, but Kennedy's commitment to enforcing court-ordered integration of southern public schools and universities drove more conservative whites into the Republican fold. In 1964, while losing in a landslide, Goldwater carried 5 southern states. However, in 1966, a lot of the white segregationists were still Southern Democrats. People like Orville Faubus and Jim Johnson and Governor George Wallace of Alabama. And the Senate was full of them. Grand characters like Richard Russell of Georgia and John Stennis of Mississippi. And some others who had no grandeur at all, just power. But President Johnson was right about the impact of the Voting Rights Act and the other civil rights efforts. By 1968, Richard Nixon and George Wallace running for president as an independent would both outpoll Humphrey in the South, and since then, the only Democrats to win the White House were 2 Southerners, Jimmy Carter and I. We won enough Southern states to get in, with huge black support and a few more white voters than a non-Southerner could have gotten. The Reagan years solidified the hold of the Republican Party on white conservative Southerners, and the Republicans made them feel welcome. President Reagan even went so far as to make a campaign speech defending states' rights and, by implication, resistance to federal meddling in civil rights in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where civil rights workers Andrew Goodman, Michael Schwerner, and James Cheney, 2 whites and 1 black, were martyred to the cause in 1964. I always liked President Reagan personally and wished he hadn't done that. In the 2002 midterm elections, even with Colin Powell and Condi Rice and other minorities holding prominent positions in the Bush administration, Republicans were still winning elections on race, with white backlashes in Georgia and South Carolina over Democratic governors removing the Confederate flag from the Georgia state flag and from the South Carolina Capitol building. Just 2 years earlier, George W. Bush had campaigned at the notoriously right-wing Bob Jones University in South Carolina, where he declined to take a stand on the flag issue, saying it was a matter for the state to decide. When a Texas school insisted on hoisting the Confederate flag every morning, Governor Bush said it was not a state, but a local issue. And they call me slick. President Johnson foresaw all this in 1965, but he did the right thing anyway, and I'm grateful he did. In the summer of 1966, and even more after the elections that fall, all the foreign and domestic conflicts were apparent in the deliberations of the U.S. Senate. When I went to work there, the Senate was full of big personalities and high drama. I tried to absorb it all. The president pro tempore, Carl Hayden of Arizona, had been in Congress since his state entered the Union in 1912 and in the Senate for 40 years. He was bald, gaunt, almost skeletal. Senator Fulbright's brilliant speechwriter, Seth Tillman, once cracked that Carl Hayden was the only 90-year-old man in the world who looks twice his age. The Senate Majority Leader, Mike Mansfield of Montana, had enlisted to fight in World War I at 15, then had become a college professor with a specialty in Asian affairs. He held the post of Majority Leader for 16 years until 1977, when President Carter appointed him ambassador to Japan. Mansfield was a fitness fanatic who walked 5 miles a day well into his 90s. He was also a genuine liberal, and behind his taciturn facade, something of a wit. He had been born in 1903, 2 years before Senator Fulbright, and lived to be 98. Shortly after I became president, Mansfield had lunch with Fulbright. When he asked Fulbright his age and Fulbright said he was 87, Mansfield replied, "Oh, to be 87 again." The Republican leader, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, had been essential to passing some of the president's legislation, providing enough liberal Republican votes to overcome the opposition of segregationist Southern Democrats.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
The Republican leader, Everett Dirksen of Illinois, had been essential to passing some of the president's legislation, providing enough liberal Republican votes to overcome the opposition of segregationist Southern Democrats. Dirksen had an amazing face, with a large mouth and lots of wrinkles, and an even more amazing voice. Deep and full, it boomed out one pithy phrase after another. Once he hit Democratic spending habits with this ditty. A billion here, a billion there. Pretty soon you're talking about real money. When Dirksen talked, it was like hearing the voice of God or a pompous snake oil salesman, depending on your perspective. The Senate looked a lot different then from how it looks today. In January 1967, after the Democrats had lost four seats in the midterm elections, they still had a margin of 64 to 36, a far more lopsided group than what we usually find today. But the differences then were deep, too, and the lines were not only drawn on party affiliation. A few things have not changed. Robert Byrd of West Virginia still serves in the Senate. In 1966, he was already the authoritative voice on the rules and history of the body. Eight states of the Old South still had two Democratic senators each, down from 10 before the 1966 elections, but most of them were conservative segregationists. Today, only Arkansas, Florida, and Louisiana are represented by two Democrats. Oklahoma had two Democrats, California two Republicans. Today it's the reverse. In the Intermountain West, now solidly Republican, Utah, Idaho, and Wyoming each had one progressive Democratic senator. Indiana, a conservative state, had two liberal Democratic senators, one of whom, Birch Bayh, is the father of current Senator Evan Bayh, a gifted leader who might be president someday, but who's not as liberal as his dad was. Minnesota was represented by the brilliant but diffident intellectual Gene McCarthy and future Vice President Walter Mondale, who succeeded Hubert Humphrey when he became President Johnson's vice president. Johnson picked Humphrey over Connecticut Senator Tom Dodd, one of the chief prosecutors of Nazis at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. Dodd's son, Chris, now represents Connecticut in the Senate. Al Gore's father was in his last term and was a hero to young Southerners like me because he and his Tennessee colleague Estes Kefauver were the only two Southern senators who refused to sign the so-called Southern Manifesto in 1956, which called for resistance to court-ordered school integration. The fiery populist Ralph Yarborough represented Texas, though the rightward future of the state was emerging with the election in 1961 of a Republican senator, John Tower, and a young Republican congressman from Houston, George Herbert Walker Bush. One of the most interesting senators was Oregon's Wayne Morse, who started out as a Republican, then became an independent, and was by 1966 a Democrat. Morse, who was long-winded but smart and tough, and Democrat Ernest Greening of Alaska were the only two senators to oppose the Tonkin Gulf Resolution in 1964, which LBJ claimed gave him authority to wage the war in Vietnam. The only woman in the Senate was a Republican who smoked a pipe, Margaret Chase Smith of Maine. By 2004, there were 14 women senators, 9 Democrats, and 5 Republicans. Back then, there were also a number of influential liberal Republicans, alas, a virtually extinct group today, including Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, the Senate's only African American, Mark Hatfield of Oregon, Jacob Javits of New York, and George Aiken of Vermont, a crusty old New Englander who thought our Vietnam policy was nuts and tersely suggested we should simply declare victory and get out. By far the most famous first-term senator was Robert Kennedy of New York, who joined his brother Ted in 1965 after defeating Senator Kenneth Keating for the seat Hillary now holds. Bobby Kennedy was fascinating. He radiated raw energy. He's the only man I ever saw who could walk stoop-shouldered with his head down and still look like a coiled spring about to release into the air. He wasn't a great speaker by conventional standards, but he spoke with such intensity and passion it could be mesmerizing. And if he didn't get everyone's attention with his name, countenance, and speech, He had Brumus, a large, shaggy Newfoundland, the biggest dog I ever saw. Brumus often came to work with Senator Kennedy. When Bobby walked from his office in the new Senate building to the Capitol to vote, Brumus would walk by his side, bounding up the Capitol steps to the revolving door on the rotunda level, then sitting patiently outside until his master returned for the walk back. Anyone who could command the respect of that dog had mine, too. John McClellan, Arkansas' senior senator, was not merely an ardent conservative. He was also tough as nails, vindictive when crossed, a prodigious worker, and adept at obtaining power and using it, whether to bring federal money home to Arkansas or to pursue people he saw as evildoers. McClellan led a life of ambition and anguish, the difficulties of which bred in him an iron will and deep resentments. The son of a lawyer and farmer, at age 17 he became the youngest person ever to practice law in Arkansas when he passed an oral examination with honors after reading law books he had checked out of the traveling library of Cumberland Law School. After he served in World War I, he returned home to find that his wife had become involved with another man, and he divorced her, a rare occurrence in Arkansas that long ago. His second wife died of spinal meningitis in 1935 when he was in the House of Representatives. 2 years later, he married his third wife, Norma, who was with him for 40 years until he died. But his sorrows were far from over. Between 1943 and 1958, he lost all three of his sons. The first to spinal meningitis, the next in a car accident, the last in a small plane crash. McClellan lived an eventful but difficult life, the sorrows of which he drowned in enough whiskey to float the Capitol down the Potomac River. After a few years, he decided drunkenness was inconsistent with both his values and his self-image, and he gave up liquor completely, sealing the only crack in his armor with his iron will. By the time I got to Washington, he was chairman of the powerful Appropriations Committee, a position he used to get our state a great deal of money for things like the Arkansas River Navigation System. He served another 12 years, a total of 6 terms, dying in 1977 after announcing he would not seek a seventh. When I worked on the Hill, McClellan seemed a remote, almost forbidding figure, which is how he wanted to be perceived by most people. After I became Attorney General in 1977, I spent quite a bit of time with him. I was touched by his kindness and his interest in my career, and wished that he had been able to show the side of him I saw to more people and to reflect it more in his public work. Fulbright was as different from McClellan as daylight from dark. His childhood had been more carefree and secure, his education more extensive, his mind less dogmatic. He was born in 1905 in Fayetteville, a beautiful Ozark mountain town in North Arkansas where the University of Arkansas is located. His mother, Roberta, was the outspoken progressive editor of the local paper, the Northwest Arkansas Times. Fulbright went to the hometown university where he was a star student and quarterback of the Arkansas Razorbacks. When he was 20, he went to Oxford on a Rhodes Scholarship. When he returned 2 years later, he was a committed internationalist. After law school and after a brief stint in Washington as a government lawyer, he came home to teach at the university with his wife Betty, a delightful, elegant woman who turned out to be a better retail politician than he was and who kept his morose side in check through more than 50 years of marriage until she died in 1985. I'll never forget one night in 1967 or 68. I was walking alone in Georgetown when I saw Senator and Mrs. Fulbright leaving one of the fashionable homes after a dinner party. When they reached the street, apparently with no one around to see, he took her in his arms and danced a few steps. Standing in the shadows, I saw what a light she was in his life. At 34, Fulbright was named president of the University of Arkansas, the youngest president of a major university in America. He and Betty seemed headed for a long and happy life in the idyllic Ozarks. But after a couple of years, his apparently effortless rise to prominence was abruptly interrupted when the new governor, Homer Atkins, fired him because of his mother's sharply critical editorials. In 1942, with nothing better to do, Fulbright filed for the open congressional seat in Northwest Arkansas. He won, and in his only term in the House of Representatives, he sponsored the Fulbright Resolution, which presaged the United Nations in its call for American participation in an international organization to preserve peace after the end of World War II. In 1944, Fulbright ran for the U.S. Senate and for a chance to get even. His main opponent was his nemesis, Governor Atkins. Atkins had a flair for making enemies, a hazardous trait in politics. Besides getting Fulbright fired, he had made the mistake of opposing John McClellan just 2 years earlier, going so far as to have the tax returns of McClellan's major supporters audited. As I said, McClellan never forgot or forgave a slight. He worked hard to help Fulbright defeat Atkins, and Fulbright did it. They both got even. Despite the 30 years they served together in the Senate, Fulbright and McClellan were never particularly close. Neither was prone to personal relationships with other politicians. They did work together to advance Arkansas's economic interests and voted with the Southern Bloc against civil rights. Beyond that, they didn't have much in common. McClellan was a pro-military, anti-communist conservative who wanted to spend tax dollars only on defense, public works, and law enforcement. He was bright but not subtle. He saw things as black or white. He spoke in blunt terms, and if he ever had any doubts about anything, he never revealed them for fear of looking weak. He thought politics was about money and power. Fulbright was more liberal than McClellan. He was a good Democrat who liked and supported President Johnson until they fell out over the Dominican Republic and Vietnam. He favored progressive taxation, social programs to reduce poverty and inequality, federal aid to education, and more generous American contributions to international institutions charged with alleviating poverty in poor countries. In 1946, he sponsored legislation creating the Fulbright Program for International Education Exchange, which has funded the education of hundreds of thousands of Fulbright scholars from the United States and 60 other countries. He thought politics was about the power of ideas. On civil rights, Fulbright never spent much time defending his voting record on the merits. He simply said he had to vote with the majority of his constituents on issues like civil rights, areas about which they knew as much as he did, which is just a euphemistic way of saying he didn't want to get beat. He signed the Southern Manifesto after he watered it down a little and didn't vote for a civil rights bill until 1970 during the Nixon administration, when he also took a leading role in defeating President Nixon's anti-civil rights nominee to the Supreme Court, G. Harold Carswell. Despite his civil rights stance, Fulbright was far from gutless. He hated sanctimonious demagogues parading as patriots. When Senator Joe McCarthy of Wisconsin was terrorizing innocent people with his blanket accusations of communist ties, he intimidated most politicians into silence, even those who loathed him. Fulbright cast the only vote in the Senate against giving McCarthy's Special Investigative Subcommittee more money. He also co-sponsored the resolution censuring McCarthy, which the Senate finally passed after Joseph Welch exposed him to the whole country for the fraud he was. McCarthy came along too soon. He would have been right at home in the crowd that took over the Congress in 1995. But back in the early 50s, a period so vulnerable to anti-communist hysteria, McCarthy was the 900-pound gorilla. Fulbright took him on before his other colleagues would. Fulbright didn't shy away from controversy in foreign affairs either, an area in which, unlike civil rights, he knew more than his constituents did or could know. He decided just to do what he thought was right and hope he could sell it to the voters. He favored multilateral cooperation over unilateral action, dialogue with, not isolation from, the Soviet Union and Warsaw Pact nations, more generous foreign assistance and fewer military interventions, and the winning of converts to American values and interests by the force of our example and ideas, not the force of arms. Another reason I liked Fulbright was that he was interested in things besides politics. He thought the purpose of politics was to enable people to develop all their faculties and enjoy their fleeting lives. The idea that power was an end in itself rather than a means to provide the security and opportunity necessary for the pursuit of happiness seemed to him stupid and self-defeating. Fulbright liked to spend time with his family and friends, took a couple of vacations a year to rest and recharge his batteries, and read widely. He liked to go duck hunting, and he loved golf, shooting his age when he was 78. He was an engaging conversationalist with an unusual, elegant accent. When he was relaxed, he was eloquent and persuasive. When he got impatient or angry, he exaggerated his speech patterns in a tone of voice that made him seem arrogant and dismissive.